6 minutes after 10, is our economy on the proverbial brink of collapse? And might that have social and political consequences of the kind we feared years ago? But then we thought, no, we're all right. There are too many differences structurally between ourselves and countries such as in North Africa, where Arab Springs had happened. And we've sort of like been quietly confident that even though economic growth, for example, is very low, that nevertheless the stability of society is not threatened by our economic woes. And then comes along economist Duma Qubule and says, no, actually, guys, this is very serious. As a country, we need to have a proper look at the data and then interpret them properly, and we do have a crisis. In fact, the sub-editor who put up his article in the Business Day went so far as to even highlight the fact that effectively at the core of the diagnostic from Duma is the idea that we need to find a way of rescuing an economy that is, in medical terms, in the ICU. What I do like about Duma, as I've been saying the whole morning, is that it doesn't stop with diagnostics, because we can all do analysis paralysis. He's also got some interesting ideas. Whether you agree or disagree with him, doesn't matter. It's economics. We can reasonably disagree. But we're going to go into the solution space after we've had a conversation about how to properly understand the beast we're dealing with. So as you hear him, give us a call, agree, disagree, engage, and let's see whether we can have a productive conversation about A, the nature and the scope of the economic challenges that we have, and B, what we're going to do about it. 011-883-0702. The lines will be open throughout this hour. Cape Tonians, 021-446-0567. Duma is the founding director of the Center for Economic Development and Transformation. Duma, it's wonderful seeing you again. Thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Yes, you're serious. Nice to be in the studio for the first time.
Yeah, and on the line, we've got Siya Beneza, who is political economist, Southern Africa director, political economy, Southern Africa. Sorry, Siya, we don't have you in the studio, but I hope we have a nice, clear line. Thanks for being part of this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Siya.
I'm going to start with you, Duma. Some things roll off the tongues of South Africa. You know, we talk about the triple challenge. Or we now have upped the ante, we talk about the quadruple challenge if we include low economic growth, poverty, inequality, and unemployment, right? What is it about the way in which you are stacking up the data that makes you conclude that actually, properly understood, the economic data really point to a dire reality?
Thanks, Eusebius. So basically, what I talk about is a lost decade that we've had in South Africa in terms of economic development. So I look at the period from 2009 to 2017, and our economy grew by just 1.6% a year, and our GDP per capita by 0.3% a year. So in per capita terms, in economic terms, that is the equivalent of standing still. So what you see now is that our GDP per capita in 2017 was lower than it was in 2013. And it is set to decline again in 2018. You will know that at about 11:30, StatsSA will be announcing whether South Africa is in a recession again. So that is a desperate situation that we are in the country at the moment. Now, you talked about the triple challenge. So in terms of unemployment, what we had is between December 2008 and the second quarter of 2018, unemployment increased by, 3.6 million people. There are now 9.5 million unemployed South Africans. The unemployment rate is about 41%, the expanded rate, which is more realistic. And for black Africans, and in the Eastern Cape, it's 46%. Now, I'm from the Eastern Cape, and that is just a calamity. This type of figure has got no precedence in other countries except in war. You know what I'm saying? So I was looking at, 2 days ago, Turkey, which is supposedly in a disaster, and I thought, wow, Turkey, 2010 to 2017, they've grown by 7% a year. The economy is more than two times our size. So despite the authoritarian regime of Erdogan, the economy has done much better than us. And then I started looking at other countries as well. You look at whichever way you slice the data. Let's talk. I use the IMF. I say emerging and developing Asia, 7.3%, sub-Saharan Africa, 4.2%. So what you know, the Africa growth story has dissipated now, but most of Africa is growing fast, But it's just that South Africa, Angola and Nigeria bring the average down because they're very large economies. Emerging and developing Europe, 3.7%. So we cannot blame our current situation on the global financial crisis as the politicians want to do. And what disturbs me as well, if you look at other indicators, poverty, 64.2% of black Africans who are classified as poor according to the upper bound poverty level. Also, if you look at inequality, there's two types of inequality. There's income inequality. According to the Gini, it's about 0.63. We are the most unequal country in the world. And if you also look at the whole issue of wealth inequality, it's even worse. The inequality, 10% of the population takes about 95% of the wealth of this country. So what I was saying in the column, Eusebius, is that this is time for desperate measures. The situation that we're in is not different from the countries in Europe after the Second World War, and they confronted the issues head on. And that is what I was saying in the column. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And we're going to talk about how to confront them head on.
Yeah.
I wonder whether you agree both with the economic description of the problem, Sia, but also the tone in terms of the sense of urgency with which we need to accept that this is something analogous to countries that are almost in post-conflict economies.
Yes, I think Gubule's analysis, I think, is quite on point, but I think he's a little bit alarmist. I think what's important is always to remember the historical legacy of where we come from and why we're here. For me, it's primarily just an issue of inequality that stuck us where we are. If you're talking about almost half of the labor market not engaged in creating value, etc., that is a serious problem. But then at the same time in South Africa, we have an overly formalized economy that doesn't allow people to engage at an informal level. And at the same time, the formal sector has been caught up in a lot of collusion, which is blocking out new entries and creating very high barriers for new entry. And so I think for me, it's a combination of these things. And I don't think that we're necessarily at a place of almost having a revolution, although other people might think differently. And there is a view that South Africa is in a sort of low latency revolution that's ongoing on a permanent basis. You look at indicators such as public protests, etc. And I think to me, it seems like a more plausible response rather than saying we are almost at a cataclysmic point where, you know, the country might be shattered apart or we might have a national revolution. I don't think that we're at that point. But obviously, we really need to deal with the issue of inequality because I believe that's primarily what is putting the economy at such a precarious position.
Can I ask you this question, Sia, before we get to the question of whether or not we should read off from these data points the possibility of a Tunisia moment? We'll come to that in a second and put that question to Duma. But when you stack up endogenous factors like structural inequality in society, isn't that just cashing out Duma's main diagnosis rather than disagreeing with it? In other words, if one of the main things that he is saying is, no, Cyril, don't tell us that when Turkey sneezes, our economy is suddenly going to be sick. Take account of the very specific internal factors about our economy, its history, the state, the private sector, civil society. All of those kinds of factors are endogenous factors. They wholly explain how we got here. So sure, there are some things that obviously in a column you won't get to because a column is not a book. But even if we add things like, say, for example, racism in the private sector, we are still dealing here with an economy that is in a crisis because of our own making. Isn't that the conclusion that is one that we need to accept instead of blaming Washington or blaming what's happening in somewhere on the borders of Eastern and Western Europe?
Most definitely. I think that is true. The source, I think the cause of really where we are is a domestic issue. It is obviously a legacy of apartheid policies that have led us to such extreme inequalities. And I think obviously in the post-apartheid period, our politicians have not really made things any better. The liberal approach towards trying to resuscitate the economy has actually exposed us much more to external shocks and fluctuations in the exchange rate, which make it difficult to continue developing or continue exporting and growing the economy. So it is definitely a historical legacy that's led us where we are, and it's mainly primarily as a result of domestic conditions. But I think the policy approach taken in the post-apartheid period has actually exposed us to more external threats and external shocks rather than dealing with the domestic challenges that we face.
I don't know whether it will be productive in this dialogue to harp on about analogies with things like social and political discontent, but as someone who cares particularly about political economy, I know, Duma, that you care not about talking economics on its own terms, but drawing the connections between economy and the base structure of society and the health of our democracy, right? Mm-hmm. So we should spend some time on that. Mm-hmm. Let's set aside the data for 1 second. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that you are not being alarmist, and why do you think that warning us that the kind of discontent that we always, as South Africans who love the exceptional narrative, think mm-hmm. that we are immune to, we should disabuse ourselves of that reality?
Okay, let's look at the unemployment. I'm sorry to get back to the data.
That's okay.
Yeah, so if you look at the type of unemployment that we have, you find it in countries that are in war-type situations. Now, if you go to the Gaza Strip, our unemployment is with... So if you look at the top 10 countries in terms of unemployment, first of all, you don't find any single country that has got a population of above 5 million. And I can't remember the thing. So okay. We're the only country, a proper country with a population of more than 5 million that has got such a high unemployment rate. So then you go and you see the truly shocking areas of the world. You go to the Gaza Strip and you see that the unemployment compares within South Africa. So for me, I don't care, but I mean, whether I'm being alarmist or not, I am just raising the issue that this is an exceptional situation. It has got very few precedents anywhere in the world, and it is not normal to have such a high rate of unemployment. Yeah.
What do you say to that, Sia?
I agree, but I think looking at the gradual way in which the situation has deteriorated, for me, is an indicator that we're not really close to the doorstep of a revolution, because the issue in all of the, you know, compared to Tunisia, Egypt, etc., the situation, the deteriorated at an escalating rate, and this is what really drove people to get into the street. But if you compare that to South Africa, our people are used to this. I think we've gotten to a point where the deteriorated nature of the economy has become so normalized that people either find a way to survive or can work.
We've just lost you there. We'll see you.
Latent.
Okay, now we've got you back. You know, I want to engage you both on this particular issue. Here's the thing for me, Sia. For the last couple of years on the speaker circuit, my basic line when corporates in particular and rich people ask me, so do you think that we will have an Arab Spring? My line has been your line, and my spiel has been very predictable. And it's really been to talk about why we have certain dissimilarities between ourselves and North Africa that make us less likely, despite similarities, to potentially have social discontent. So people will point out some of the economic similarities, the way that Duma is doing. But for example, they will leave out salient differences, such as the fact that we are a democracy, we've got civil society, we've got vigorous opposition and media in this country as well. We've got constitutional supremacy. And often when we do case comparators, we leave out the question, what are the differences between A and B? And we sometimes obsess about similarities and then we draw quick inferences. But here's the thing. The reason why Duma's analysis struck me as interesting and worth revising my own insistence that we are definitely immune to social discontent and even revolution is because I'm thinking to myself, for how long can the formal elements of our democracy, including our economy, be a guarantor against social discontent, violence on the streets, when the hollowing out of state institutions, which we are learning through what we've come to learn with state capture, for example, has a direct material effect on the well-being of people? Let's bring it home with the most recent example in the news cycle. Look at the looting that has happened, for example, most recently on the streets of the south of Joburg. And when I see those images, I think of Duma's article, which is why I invited him on the show, because I think to myself, there you have the dots being connected between the economic analysis and why it is we should not be glib about what this can mean in terms of social discontent.
Yes, but I still think that the way in which the state and the geographic part of the economy has been structured is such that it insulates all of those uprisings in either townships or far-flung rural areas. And I think this was the inherent intention of the apartheid state policy. And so this is where I think the institutional aspects of South African economy are important to understand beyond just sort of interpreting the economic data on its own. I think at an institutional level, there are just many things that are structurally tying people, in a position of discontent, but not outright national, outcry. So, for example, if you compare the organizing that happened about a year ago when the taxi strike happened over the financing arrangements for new taxis, that was for me a much more organized expression of discontent than we've even seen for things like the national fight against gender violence and other many causes that South Africans so seemingly organize themselves around. So it seems as though we're either just disintegrated in terms of what we care about and sort of people are caught up in their silos or pockets, or such that wherever there's a possibility for people to organize and come together, we either have that insulated in townships or far-flung areas, or as we saw in the case of Marikana, the state is quite quick to respond when it has an impact on the economy.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to say a couple of things. You know, Eusebius, I wouldn't say the penny dropped at this moment, but I once listened to a show at El Dorado Park, and I listened to the desperate conditions that the people in El Dorado Park are in. And some of the things that they were saying we would have found objectionable in, Santa, the communities that we work with. But I said, no, I can't blame them. If I was under the same conditions that they are in, I would probably come to the same conclusions. And then, so that was just one example of it. You know, also what I'm noticing as well is that the middle class is squeezed. Eusebius, I know you've got friends and I saw with the little, the petrol price increase and the mood has just changed even amongst the so-called middle class. And then the third thing I want to talk about is that the situation is getting worse. Now, we are now at 9.5, 9.6 million unemployed. I've predicted for quite a while that we're heading for 10 million unemployed. Now, at what point, can you imagine the ANC going to election with 10.5 unemployed, 11 unemployed? So what I'm saying is that what we will get very soon, if it continues to worsen, is that, let alone the EFF coming into power, somebody that you've never heard of will suddenly be our president. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Koketso, good morning to you and welcome to the show.
Yeah. Morning, Eusebius.
Go ahead.
Morning. Yeah, morning to your guests too. Yeah, Eusebius, I think they both make very compelling arguments, but I think where I'm more inclined to side with Duma and this is that, particularly when you're in the rural areas and in the townships, it's alarming how many people are just unemployed. I mean, you drive through the townships and you just see people are just everywhere. And this is during a workday, during the week, And hence why you even say now with these, strikes that are happening in Soweto and stuff, how there were all those people there in place to meet because people are not working. People are at home and they're not working. So, you cannot have a population where majority, particularly below, what's worrying for me is below the age of 40. Okay, certain people who are now fast approaching that point where they've never ever worked in their entire lifetime. And these people are the ones that are going to cause, economic instability in the country because they're supposed to be the economically active people. So we need to, and this is also where I also agree with Sia, according to where, private sector business is actually smothering small business interests by putting all this legislation and all these barriers to entry, thereby making it difficult for new entrants to get into the market and for SMEs to thrive and for the SMEs to then turn around and create jobs. So we need to address this thing structurally, but we also need short-term measures that can find a way to employ the mass of people that we have that are in the townships and in the rural areas.
Okay, thanks for that. I want to change tack first. In the second half of this hour, we will talk squarely about solutions. What should be the role of the Reserve Bank, for example?
what kind of emergency injection into the economy is possible, where would such cash come from anyway. And so there's a range of obviously forward-looking economic questions I want to ask of both Siya and Duma. But let's just wrap up the analysis of the problem in the next 2 or 3 minutes for the first half, Duma. I want to ask you this question. We are often obsessed, and maybe appropriately so, with state-centric analysis of the political economy in the country. What are your reflections on the fact that the economy implicates all of us by definition in terms of how labor markets are structured? Those who are excluded, the unemployed, the unions have enormous power, particularly in this country, for good but also interesting reasons. It can sometimes be perverse in their effect. There's the state that has enormous legislative power and opportunity to effect change through regulatory environment, etc. But then there's also the private sector as well. And the way you stack up the stats was compelling to me, but there wasn't much of a disaggregation, and obviously it's partly because of space, in terms of these different partners that all collectively make up the economy. Where, for example, is your analysis here on one of the things that irritate the state, which is low levels of local investment on the part of the private sector?
Yes, okay, I'm glad you asked for that, and I'll go out on a limb here. Okay, so many of my colleagues talk about an investment strike. Now, you will know, Eusebius, that there's two... you know, in South Africa, we've got one single narrative of the economy. And I think I'm in the column, I want to introduce different narratives of the economy. Now, the investment strike, I don't agree with that. There is no investment strike. So I'm out on a limb. Now, let me explain what I mean on this. Yeah.
No way.
No. I'll explain.
Give
them
a chance and then you'll
come
back.
What I'm trying to say is that there is nobody who's going to invest in a country where the cost of capital is so high and the economy is not growing. It doesn't stack up. So every debate has an ideology. So if you look at it from the Keynesian point of view, which I subscribe to, investment is a function of demand. It is not a function of business confidence.
Or patriotism.
Or patriotism or whatever. So investment responds to rising GDP with a lag of about, let's say, a year or two. So you don't get investment appearing out of nowhere to lead private sector investment to lead the economy. Now, there is one example where that happened. Now, in the early 2000s, we had expansionary monetary and fiscal policies after the end of GEAR. Interest rates came down from 2003 to 2005 by 650 basis points. So the stimulus that initially got the economy going was a rise in consumption spending. The second issue that happened is that the public sector started spending again after not spending for many years. So your Eskom is and your Transnet. So there was a massive increase in government capital formation. And then the private sector joined after that, and our fixed investment rate went up to the magical 25%. We were a shade from that. So the economy doesn't work where the private sector leads investments. I have to emphasize that. Very important, yeah. And we've got it back to front. The public sector must lead the way in terms of investment, and the public investment crowds in private investment. Now, if the public sector is not investing, I'll use a concrete example. The public sector stopped investing in terms of infrastructure, and all the construction companies are collapsing, merging, business rescue. What do you expect them to do? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Now that he's cashed out why he says there's no investment strike, Siya, would you like to change the phrase no ways to yes ways?
No, I definitely disagree. I think there's a clear, investment and even tax avoidance strategies that the private sector has been engaged with. If you look at things, for example, such as the overcapitalization of our JSE stock exchange, which is capitalized to 300% of GDP, this is not normal. And then if you look at things like, if just take a walk around Sandton, look at all the fancy business parks and offices that are being constructed instead of creating employment. And also there's multiple studies such as the CRED study, Center for Competition Regulation and Economic Development, which found that there are huge cash reserves that the private sector is still just not investing in. And if you look at our foreign direct investment to the rest of the continent, that has been shooting up. And I think, look, the issue of whether growth comes first or investment comes first is an ongoing chicken and egg philosophical debate.
But what about, before I go to the news break, what about not growth versus investment chicken and egg, but demand?
that there has to be a rational economic response to demands in the economy. And the way I'm hearing Duma is that before you can say, dudes, please demonstrate to the rest of the world that you can have confidence in the local economy and invest locally so that FDI can actually follow that, there must be a rational argument for investing your money here, quite apart from the fact that there is a Tuma Mina campaign. Is there a demand?
Well, firstly, I think the population in South Africa is relatively small. We only have 60 million. So the demand is small necessarily as the, you know, the population size. But then again, add issues such as inequality, which, you know, which also contribute to less or less demand. So without job creation, there is no growth in demand. And I think what he's talking about, private sector investment leading public sector investment, it's been public sector investment that's been leading. So if you look at 2011, the figures from 2011 to 2017, growth has averaged 10.2% in terms of general government public investment compared to private sector growth, which is at about 7.1%. But what's more shocking and alarming is the the limited contribution of our state-owned enterprises, which are supposed to champion development in terms of the public
sector, which
has not been investing, obviously for multiple reasons, such as state capture, etc. So I think from my perspective, without creating jobs, without employing people, or at least stimulating concertedly in entrepreneurialism and informal sector, there will be no demand to speak of.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a second, including the SOEs. 24 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're having a really stunning and interesting economic debate, and I'm enjoying having a front row seat here as the moderator between two excellent economists, Siya Benisa, and also here in the studio with me is Duma Qubule. And we're asking the question, what is the true nature of the crisis we are facing? We know that we have a crisis. I mean, that's not news to us. But to really fully understand the most accurate description of the beast we are dealing with, for most of this half of the conversation, I do want to go into solutions mode, because like I said, you can't have an intervention without understanding the problem. On the other hand, as South Africans, we are also addicted to paralysis analysis, because we often just end at the diagnostic stage of a conversation and we don't talk enough about, okay, so where to from here? And in this column that have been the trigger for today's debate that was written by Duma, he actually, to his credit, has got a couple of really interesting creative ideas about how to deal in the short and in the long term with some of our woes. Before we go to him on that question, a couple more of your interventions. Tami, good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Abius. Great show.
Thank you, sir.
I would like to say, first of all, I share the sentiments of Duma. And I would also like to point out that Sia's opposition, as far as I'm concerned, it undermines or underappreciates the connection between politics and economics. What do I mean by that? Everything that is happening in this country is happening because of political decisions. Yes, we may try to outsource the decision and quote all the other international economic sectors, but I'll give you an example of a deliberate political decision that was taken by politicians. The 2008 crisis, the country was almost not touched, our country, because a political decision was made by the leadership that our banks should be independent, and as a result, are regulated. And they were not engaged in speculative engagement in debt. That was a political decision. And the reason I'm raising that, we're insulated in that crisis, but at the moment, this country is suffering from a leadership that is visionless, that absolutely has no plan.
I don't think Sia disagrees so much with that. He was just expanding what the sources of the problem are. The real question is, let me ask you this, Tami. Forget about what Sia has said. Do you, as Tami, think that there is a realistic possibility of us having our Tunisia moment?
If by that you mean changing an administration, come 2019, absolutely. But
I'm not talking about democracy as usual. I'm talking about violent unrest on a large scale.
No, if we call these strikes that we're having violence, then I disagree. That is not violence. That is just a small part of it. true violence would bring this country to a standstill. But I'm thinking that revolution is not going to come through violent means. It's going to come through the ballot of
Tunisia. Okay, then you don't disagree deeply with Sia. Blessing, good morning, very quickly.
Good morning, Eusebius. How are you?
Good, thank you, sir.
All right. Yeah, no, I wish actually that many people or the whole population in the country should actually be listening to this kind of discussion, because it impacts all of us. We need to stop doing whatever we're doing and really look at this very seriously.
Yeah.
While I might not agree with the fact that revolution is just around the corner, because it's actually happening in certain spots, in drips and drabs, especially in townships. My biggest worry is that government, I don't think there's political will to solve the economic problems of the country. Why am I saying that? The reason is because the ANC government is, they want to stay in power. And if they have to stay in power, they've got to make sure that they appease people like COSATU, because there's no factories coming into South Africa. There's no new skills being learned. But everyone is afraid of unions, like COSATU, when they talk about a decent living wage and stuff like that. You've got to start somewhere. You don't just get to be successful at the drop of a hat. There's got to be a process that you started here, and you grew, and you went higher. Then you are earning the salary that you deserve. But most of the time, our people don't really want that. And all these townships where there's violence, people don't even want to pay for their services. There's nobody paying.
Okay, I hear you, Blessing. I want to change tech now. Duma, let's talk solutions. And there's lots here to talk about, right? We're not going to do it all in one sitting. But there are parts of your analysis that caught my attention that's quite interesting. There's been a big debate around the ownership of the South African Reserve Bank. I think that's a distraction. I think the real issue is the one that implicitly you frame, which is we need to talk about its mandate, and then we can reasonably disagree about what its mandate should be. In respect of that question, inflation targeting, the argument has always been, sure, we need economic growth. Sure, we need more people to be employed. But my God, the cost of living is expensive. It is expensive to be poor. It's even more expensive to be poor than to be middle class in the north. And so having a inflation target focus makes sense because it is pro-poor and it is pro-black. What's wrong with that argument?
Okay, let's start there. Sorry to sort of jump from... Now, Koketso earlier on, she hit the nail on the head. She says there are structural issues, which Sia also talked about, but we need short-term interventions to alleviate the situation. So in my input, I'm not saying that there aren't structural issues in our economy, the issues of competition that Sia talks about. We have to address those. But in the short term, I just want to talk quickly about the structure, because this is the pushback against what I'm saying. So the IMF, let's just talk of the high priests of capitalism. Their definition is rather narrow. They talk about, for example, flexible labor markets. It must be easy to hire and fire. And number two, they talk about competition in product markets, i.e. there must be more competition in the economy, the stuff that Sia talks about. But South African ordinary people, they talk about issues relating to the education system, the productivity of people who are unemployed and so forth. So, but I'm saying we must address some of those issues, but they are not going to solve the problem in the short term. And that is what even the IMF has said. The IMF has said that the labor market interventions that they talk about will reduce economic growth in the short term, and they should be accompanied with expansionary monetary and fiscal policies. So I just wanted to address ahead of time the pushbacks. Now, let's talk about the Reserve Bank. This is a difficult one, okay, because it's a very short time. I could talk about this forever. You know, I watched a documentary recently called The Princes of the Yen. The Princes of the Yen is about how the central bank in Japan deliberately started a crisis in the early 90s or the late 80s because they wanted to convert the entire Japanese. Japan had a success after the war from 1945 to 1990, and amazing, where they became the second largest economy in the world. But there were a lot of American educated people in Japan who believed that they must shift towards a free market system. And so they said, we will create a crisis in Japan. And so what that documentary showed me is that the central bank, when it operates, is potentially the most powerful institution in the country, more important than even National Treasury or the whole of government. So I believe that central banks are very important thing. So now let me just quickly talk about why I think. I'll talk about short term and long term if you give me time. So
why are you running away from the mandate question?
No, I'm coming to it. Yeah, I think the problem with that is that most South Africans don't understand the role of the central bank in this crisis. Now let's get back to the mandate. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So now,
because it's harder off paper,
no? I'll do it. Yeah. So on the mandate. Now, look at the countries that have achieved fast growth. They have multiple objectives, and they have multiple, multiple instruments. Now, we have a primitive system of managing our monetary policy, and it's based on a single objective and a single target. So now, I use the example of Japan, because Japan had multiple objectives, and the central bank used multiple tools to achieve their objectives. I'll use an example, China recently. After the global
fund... Let me grant you the following.
Okay.
For sake of expediency.
Okay.
Firstly, I will grant you that the be-all and the end-all of how we deal with our economic woes cannot be the mandate of the South African Reserve Bank. We've got to talk about the private sector, state-owned enterprises, as SIA has flagged for us. We've got to talk about the economic cluster, a range of things. So even the amount of attention the debate about the SARB is getting is disproportionate to where it ought to fit into our overall solution space. I grant you firstly that. I grant you that multiple objectives and a toolkit with many different interventions are needed to deal with the economy. All of that preparatory work, take it for granted me and SIA. Now let's get to the next question here.
Yeah.
If you had a gun against your head and for some reason that morning your toolbox fell open and the tools are missing and you can only find two tools, one to keep inflation between 3% and 6%, two to do something with interest rates that may yet be conducive to increasing economic growth, what would Duma choose?
Okay, let me explain to you. Inflation targeting, one target, one tool. It's a primitive way of conducting your monetary policy. And I was using the example of China after the global financial crisis. They've got a wide range of tools that they use to control inflation. They've got reserve requirements. They've got differential interest rates. They've got credit quotas. They've got they've got so many tools that they use to control the price level. So what I'm trying to say, inflation targeting for me is just primitive because I think, so let me just explain. So now what's happening as well is that the excessive focus on inflation resulted in the central bank causing the downturn that followed the global financial crisis. Before the start of the crisis in 2007, in June 2007, they increased interest rates by 250 basis points. After 2007, they increased interest rates by 250 basis points. So while every central bank in the world was cutting rates, we increased our rates by 500 basis points, and we lost 1 million jobs the following year. So that is why I had to prefix it and show that this institution is very important.
So let me bring you in here. I've been fawning over the article written by Duma, but I have to say this is the most woolly and cagey that he has been this hour. And I suspect it's because there are obvious differences between ourselves and the central bank in the USA, for example, where if you look at levels of employment in the economy in general and economic growth, you can afford to say to the central bank there, listen, dudes, make sure that when you take from your toolkit and you make an announcement in relation to, say, interest rates or whatever, that you actually try and keep in mind that one of your core functions is unemployment. Now, Duma in his article is a bit less cagey than he is now on my show. He wants unemployment to be the thing that is foremost on the mind of the South African Reserve Bank. But I'm thinking to myself, Sia, but what about poor people? What about the people who work for you and I as domestic workers? The cost of living will increase if we don't keep inflation within that band. What say you?
I think the obsession with inflation is a rich people's policy. It makes no difference in your life if you don't have an income, whether the price of bread increases over the inflation rate tomorrow. I think Firstly, we need to understand that changing the Reserve Bank's mandate is not a short-term solution. The Reserve Bank's mandate is a dual mandate. It's on price and exchange rate stability. And this is a constitutional mandate. So it's in the Constitution that, you know, that enables or empowers the Reserve Bank to take on this mandate. And then the second point I want to make is that in the operations of the Reserve Bank, there's something called, referred to as the inescapable trinity, right? So central banks can either control two of the three next variables. That is the foreign capital flows, exchange rate, and interest rate, and you cannot control all three. So our Reserve Bank chooses to control the exchange rate as well as the interest rate, and at the same time opens up the foreign capital flows, and so we have a liberalized capital account. What this means is that whenever the sentiments of investors change, and they are willy-nilly, and they are at the whims of you know, people with money, this has a direct impact on the economy. And the second thing is that in price, stability mandate, without looking at unemployment, is not what we need currently. If I can just look at some of the external FDI flow. So from South Africa to the rest of the world, we've increased our foreign direct investment stock from $23 billion in 95 to $270 billion in 2017. And over the last 3 years, if you look from 2015 to 2017, it's increased from 49% of GDP to 85% of GDP. So what we're faced with is an outflow of capital. We've got you know, capital flight from South Africa. And this is also another thing to add to, you know, the assertion that there is no investor strike, or, you know, but there clearly is if we're investing in the rest of the world and not domestically. You might argue...
Sneaking that one back in there. Okay, let's take a break there, Sia. There's some interesting agreement here, actually, between you and Duma on inflation targeting. I'm not convinced, but you two are the experts. As we take a break, here's a question, and either one of you can attempt to convince me otherwise. I think it is irresponsibly glib of you to pretend, Sia, that inflation targeting is the concern of the rich person, precisely because, as Duma said at 20 past 10, even working, even middle-class South Africans are squeezed. We cannot be glib about the cost of living. So if we take the reality that South African economy has got a lot of working poor, in other words, people who are nominally in the labor market, get a wages or even a salary, but it doesn't go very far. We can't pretend as if the only people that are affected by a debate about inflation targeting are the wealthy. Most of us who are actually employed care deeply about the cost of living, and we have to.
Eusebius Makaiser.
Eusebius Makaiser.
On 702 at Cape Talk.
Duma, why don't you care about the cost of my basket of Woolies goods?
No, I do care, Eusebius. Let me just quickly say, you said I'm Woolies, so I get back to the point quickly. Yeah? So I believe that we should scrap this inflation targeting system, number one. We should change the mandate of the central bank to include growth and employment. And offline, I did explain that the US, with a dual mandate, jobs and inflation, has outperformed Europe, which has got a narrow mandate in terms of whatever. So even in the recent period from the global financial crisis, the US Federal Reserve kept interest rates low for a very long period. It wouldn't have kept rates so low if it was only focused on inflation. So that is how I believe that we should run our monetary policy, especially since we've got a jobs crisis. And New Zealand, which started off with this inflation targeting, the Labour government recently introduced a broader mandate of jobs and inflation for the country. So I think that we should also change the composition of this monetary policy committee, and I also advocate for emergency measures on the monetary policy side to get the economy working. Now, I've been on a one-man campaign for this monetary and fiscal stimulus, and
Outline it to us.
Yeah. So let me just tell you. So the first part of it is a monetary stimulus. I think an instruction, a letter should go from the president, or there should be an emergency meeting. And we should give an escape clause for this inflation. We should tell them, because the mandate will take long to change. So we should say that, listen here, Mr. Lesetša Kganyako, can you please concentrate on growth for now until we have an acceptable growth and employment rate? Okay. And an escape clause from this inflation target. And I believe that there should be an emergency cut in interest rates of about a minimum of 200 basis points to create more liquidity into the system. Okay. That's number one. Okay. Number two, there's also a fiscal stimulus.
I'm very keen to hear that, and also how it differs from the begging bowls that are being sent into the world.
Yeah. So quick one, the fiscal stimulus. Now, I should be celebrating when the ANC, suddenly the word fiscal stimulus appears in their statements. But when I was very busy that week, when the ANC announced its fiscal stimulus, so it took me about 3 or 4 days until I started looking to this. Said, no, 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 this is not a fiscal stimulus. They have, I should sue them for misusing the term. But anyway, so a fiscal stimulus, after the global
fund. What is it properly understood?
So a fiscal stimulus is new money into the economy. So after the global financial crisis, virtually every developing country and developed country had a fiscal stimulus. Mm. So the Chinese one was 600 billion. The Obama one was 787 billion. And the Chinese one was 15% of GDP.
Where does it come from?
They create new money. So the central bank can also create money on the thing, on the other side. The government also borrows more money however they raise it. So what I'm trying to say is that every single country used these tools to get their economies growing, after the global financial crisis. And the global financial crisis for the rest of the world ended long ago.
Okay.
And we still have a crisis here.
I want to give Siya a chance to respond to two things, whether we should whisper to the Reserve Bank to focus on growth, and also whether you like this idea of a stimulus. But in 30 seconds, firstly, you, Duma, I just want to be crystal clear here. Would you be prepared, because you anticipate, properly used, the fiscal stimulus can do amazing things for growth, that you'd be willing to raise money, even if that potentially means having a deficit or worrying about borrowing, that could potentially be dangerous? Because that's the usual reason why we don't want to raise capital and lock in future generations who are now at school, who will have to pay off that debt.
Great question. So I'd say that our debt levels in South Africa, net debt after cash reserves of the government, is 47% of GDP.
Yeah.
There is no universe in the world where that is high.
Okay.
That's number one. But there are ways in which you can finance the stimulus that minimizes the impact on the debt.
Yeah. Okay. I love the fact that you are creative and interventionist about what one might do. Siya, what do you think about some of these ideas?
All right. I just mainly have 3 points to make, Eusebius. I think my first point is just to double back on the issue, on the comment I made that, you know, inflation obsession, at least, with the inflation targeting is a rich man. So if I can give just a quick example, if I have R1 billion, you know, stashed in some bank and inflation's at 10%, what that means is on an average basis, if inflation's at 10%, my purchasing power declines by R100 million, right? Mm-hmm. And if you compare that with the price of bread, if price of bread is below 10 rand and inflation is at 10%, that means that the next day the loaf of bread might be 11 rand.
Sure.
So you clearly see that the impact of inflation is very different depending on how much wealth you have.
Of course.
The second point I want to make is inflation is also part of the growth story, right? So obsession with cutting inflation is also, you know, constraining growth at the same time. Because why do we have inflation? Inflation is a consequence of prices adjusting first before production adjusts. So as demand increases and people cannot meet the demand, the price adjusts because people realize you can actually increase the price of this good. There's a lot of demand.
Yes.
And the growth story, and this is why we have a difference between nominal and real growth. But at the end of the day, the point I'm trying to make is that countries like Turkey, for example, at 10% inflation, were still able to manage 7% growth.
Okay, no, makes sense. Okay, final thought, because you're backing down after I've guilt tripped you about inflation. You've made some excellent comebacks there, but now we've run out of time. So in 20 seconds, just your intuition, we can have a full version next time around the idea of a stimulus properly understood.
I think a stimulus is necessary. It's needed, but I think we also need to take care of the issues that have you know, undermined the developmental impact of state-owned enterprises such as state capture, etc. So the stimulus package on its own is not a solution without ensuring that money is adequately spent in creating jobs and not misappropriated towards private interests.
Siya and Duma, you guys have been excellent. I've enjoyed this debate. I could moderate it for another 2 hours. Thank you so much.